from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of a program weaving music and stories called Made in Indiana.
I'll revisit part of an interview that I did with Maestro Christoph Urbanski.
And I'll find out about the Theater on the Square production of Skylight, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Writer-storytellers Philip Gawley and Scott Russell Sanders join singer-songwriters Tim Grimm and Krista Detour on Friday, January 15th, in a performance that weaves together stories and music in a bicentennial celebration of all things Hoosier. The performance takes place at 7:30 p.m. in the Grand Hall at the Indiana Landmarks Center, and Sharon Gamble found out more in this recent conversation.
Made in Indiana, where did this idea come from?
I got an email from Mr. Phil Gawley. He said, "Let's do something this winter," and it was addressed to three of us: Krista Detour in Bloomington, and Scott Russell Sanders in Bloomington. And
had the four of you done something before?
The four of us have we, Phil?
I think
something?
So. Yeah, we've
maybe
done
one
some,
time.
Yeah.
We've done one time. We've been all together in one place.
That's been a few years ago, right?
Yeah. Certainly. We've all worked in various couplings.
Mm-hmm.
Phil and I try to get together at least every year or two to do something. And Krista and I work a lot together, and Scott. And so it's a real treat for the four of us to get in one place.
Sure. Yeah.
You three did Wilderness Plots together.
We did.
Yeah.
So how does it work? Because we've got musicians / singer-songwriters, and then we have spoken word people. So take me through the brainstorming meeting where the four of you said, well, what if the organizing principle was about Indiana and we're kind of celebrating the bicentennial? What was that breakfast like, or where whatever that form
took?
Well,
it was mostly done through email, and I suggested that I be the one who sing. And that idea was quickly vetoed by the other three.
I've seen you many times, but I don't think I've heard you sing.
And you don't.
You
want to
do that for us now? Okay, then.
Oh, I think just the recognition that all four of us are passionate about the same things. And
for example?
Well, community and a concern for our ecology, for our world, and how it's shaping up, and what we'll leave for our children and now grandchildren for some of us, things that we're very passionate about, and it's kind of our gospel, and we want to spread it.
Well said.
Yeah.
So, Tim, do you get Scott and Phil to tell stories and then say, oh, I have a song that illustrates this?
I don't get them to do anything.
Okay.
Those two are grown men, and they will do as they please.
Okay.
I think that for this particular evening in Indianapolis, and coincidentally we'll also be doing another night in Columbus, Indiana.
The same weekend, right?
The same weekend, yeah. Right. The 16th, the next night, Saturday night, will be in Columbus. Friday night will be in Indianapolis at mm-hmm. Landmarks. I think, you know, Phil spoke. It was so succinct that exactly what he said that what we're doing, you know, we're combining essays, we're combining short stories, and we're combining music in a way that both, you know, conveys the art of what we do with the message of what we all do. And we all have a little different angle at that, you know, we all have a little different approach, but Phil described a great umbrella. You know, for me, right now, it's thinking about, I've often over these last several years thought about progress and growth, those two words, you know, and what how they're so easily defined by so many people, and they often become, for so many people, the same thing. And I like to step back and think about progress and growth. I like to think about, I really think, spend a lot of my time thinking about technology and what technology not only does for us, you know, in our state, in our own backyard, what it's doing for the world and how that reflects back on us. And that, to me, is a fascinating, endless topic to think about, you know, what technology is doing to the world and to human beings right now.
Yeah, what it does for us, but maybe also what it does to us.
Exactly.
Not 100% positive?
Exactly. Wow. Yeah, yeah.
You were about to say, sorry, I interrupted.
Oh, no, no. I think that's just an important consideration. I'm reading a book now. I believe the name of it is The Last Child Outdoors.
Oh.
And it talks about, it's I think, about the book's about 10 years old. But it's just a wonderful book because it talks about the effect of technology on children and how it has contributed to their nature deficit. The children don't play outside anymore. They don't explore the woods. They don't engage nature. And the ramifications of that, how in the world do we begin to talk to a generation about the importance of preserving natural spaces when we haven't even helped them inculcate an appreciation for that environment.
You both have children. Have you talked to your own children about this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons my son has become a farmer. My older son has become a farmer. And the way in which he's done it, which is as natural and organic as possible. Yeah. Yeah, to be a real steward of the land.
Yeah, and to take that role, you have to be exposed to it. You have to to see it in great detail.
Yeah, yeah.
And your kids have grown up mostly on your farm.
They have indeed. I mean, Phil and I are just about the same age, and we both grew up. We are the four, the two Hoosiers in the bunch, born and raised here. Of course, I did go off for a while and have lived in the big cities and made a very conscious choice to come back, and raise the boys here, you know, near Brown County, where I where my first memories were formed. And I think that a lot of what, yes, we've talked to our boys as well, but I think I would imagine that the Gully boys and our boys, we have modeled things for them in in a sense. They've walked their own path, but they've got this experience of having lived in a particular way in a place. That's as good as anything we could have given them, you know, I think, ultimately.
If you had to define Indiana values or rural Indiana values, could you? Is that a bit of an organizing principle of you, the bond the four of you performers have?
Well, if I were to say what I believe the principle Hoosier value is, it's hospitality. And that this has very distinct political ramifications.
How so?
Well, if we have an ethos of hospitality, that means that we are as concerned about the rights of gays and lesbians as we are the rights of heterosexuals.
We're concerned about the rights of non-Christians.
Yes, that's right.
Well, we should be, certainly, if we uphold this notion. And that is probably the biggest catchphrase if people think about Indiana, Hoosier hospitality.
That's right.
That's been around forever,
since
we were kids.
So what does that mean if we take it seriously? It means that we don't have litmus tests for public office. We don't insist that our office holders be Christian. We only insist that they be intelligent and ethical, and have the best interests of the state at heart.
That's a tall order right there.
That is a tall order, but I think hospitality demands it. It means in this day and age that we're open to become a welcoming place for refugees, and that these are not New Age values that are the concerns of the moment. They are as old as time itself. They are rooted in our spiritual traditions, our ethical traditions, and they have served us well, and we forsake them at our own risk. Hmm.
It's astonishing to me, really, that people still want to be public servants. It's such a hard job. Even just to articulate, let alone to fight for the principles you just outlined right there.
I would imagine, though, that there's much joy in it also. When I see certain elected officials go about their business who do it well, they seem to do it with a real verve and buoyancy. I saw a picture in yesterday's Indianapolis Star of our outgoing mayor, Greg Ballard, performing a same-gender marriage, and the expression on his face was beautiful. He was clearly pleased to be there as a public servant mm-hmm. and to unite in marriage two gay men. And I thought, as I saw that, now that is Hoosier hospitality. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it didn't look burdensome at all. It looked very joyous to me.
Tim, where do you get ideas when you're writing songs? Do they just come to you as you're doing
out of
something
the air
else?
And you pull them out of the ground. I reach into my bookshelf. I mean, a song can come from anywhere, and the songs come to me as I walk the back fields on our farm. The songs come to me when I pull a Scott Russell Sanders book of short stories off the bookshelf and realize that these can come to life out of the page. And they come to me when I'm driving around thinking about some of these very things we're talking about, and I become passionately engaged. I become emotionally engaged. I become occasionally angry at things, and I got to write them down.
Yeah.
Is your process similar, Phil?
Yeah, I've always been surprised at where inspiration strikes. Since I write and have to make my living doing that, I've found that it often strikes when I'm sitting at my desk working.
Well, that's convenient.
That is convenient. But
it means you've trained your muse well, right?
but I think if I've done any work that endures, that really resonates, it seems to have been those ideas that were just gifts that just kind of floated down out of the ether and caught me unaware. I mean, gave me a thought or an insight that, and I just think, I don't know where that came from, but I'm glad it came.
Here it is. Let's capture it.
Yeah.
I suspect that as we're having this conversation a week or so before your concert pair, that you're still tweaking things. But do you have at this point a favorite moment of the?
No, absolutely. We're still tweaking things. We're still tweaking things.
We'll be tweaking right up until.
Yeah, you know, I think an objective probably will be to try to weave what the four of us do together, and to not have, you know, these very separate, disparate set pieces. You know, one guy goes for 15 minutes and, you know, knock it down. I think that we can find ways, and we will find ways to kind of blend it together, weave it together, make it more interesting, you know. Connect us better, both our stories and our messages.
Yeah. We'll see if we can pull that off.
Sharon Gamble with Philip Gawley and Tim Grimm. Made in America, an evening with Philip Gawley, Scott Russell Sanders, Krista Detour, and Tim Grimm will take place in the Grand Hall at the Indiana Landmark Center on Friday, January 15th at 7:30. More information and tickets are available at Eventbrite. Just type in Made in Indiana.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Last year, Travis DiNicola interviewed Maestro Christoph Urbanski to talk about the ISO's 2015-2016 season. With the ISO's Out of This World Cosmos Music Festival coming up later this month, we thought we would revisit the part of the interview where Mr. Urbanski talks about music and space.
Tell me a bit about your choice to have this Cosmos theme.
It's since I was maybe, 13, maybe 14 when actually, because I started musical studies when I was 12. So I was already doing classical music, and then around 14, 15, I discovered science. And, it's a really big deal for me, you know, and the science and music, these are two things I love the most, probably. And I was always very, very much interested in particular, in cosmology and astronomy. So, but I had to choose. Well, I was always actually dreaming to become a scientist, a cosmologist preferably. But I choose classical music, of course. I do not regret that because, you know, even being conductor, I can do something great, like a festival of music based on the same topic, which is cosmos. So for me, it's just simple dream come true. The two things that I love the most. And, cosmos is, if you go a little more philosophical, I think you might consider music as the universe, because it does not exist, really. I mean, it's so abstract. I think this is the most abstract form of art of all. So many composers realize that, and they are actually, every piece of music could be considered its own universe. Like every piece of music that happens to be created, for instance, Beethoven Mind, his Fifth Symphony, it's a complete universe. And especially that it's created out of nothing. He doesn't need anything material, to create it, because it exists only in his mind. Of course, we have performance, we have notes on paper, and they make this abstract thing exist during performance, and they pass it to the viewer, to the listeners. And, so altogether, this festival is something I'm actually very proud of, and I hope it will be well received, because we are planning to do concerts on two topics. One is music in cosmos, and then cosmos in music. So these two perspectives. So cosmos in music, I see as all the inspirations from that topic that inspired composers. Like, for instance, Gustav Holst wrote a cycle of several movements, each in his kind of biggest symphony work, when he describes each of the planets. But this is mainly inspired by astrology.
I was just going to say, when I first heard that there was going to be a music series based on the cosmos, I thought, okay, of course you've got to have the planets, and it's great to have 2001. But I think the most interesting choice of music that's in here are the pieces of music that were also included in the Voyager time capsule.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes back to what you were saying in terms of music being its own, in a way, its own language, its own universe, or else why would the scientists who put that music on the Voyager time capsule do so? I mean, they were kind of anticipating this, like, universal language of science and sound, right?
No, I think it's much more, actually, the universal language. Because imagine that it happened in the future, that this capsule arrived somewhere and someone or something reads that message. Because there is on this golden record, there is a very precise description how to listen to it and how to get all the data from this record. So, and they're listening to it. I'm trying to imagine what would they think of us as humans listening to first movement of Beethoven Fifth Symphony, which is so perfect. I consider the complexity of our brain, the fact that there were humans, or we as humans, because I consider Beethoven Fifth as one of the greatest achievements of all of us, that we are able to write something that perfect, something that just existed in our mind. And we can make the music, we can put it as waves, as a music on the record, something so abstract and something that is so perfect. You know, the form of the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, I considered perfect. And well, the music, on the other hand, there is so much more emotions in it and so many things that makes us human.
Mm-hmm.
So I think these people would consider us gods. Or because, well, and I'm so proud that I'm a human. That's unbelievable because our skills are unlimited. Well, there are no limits. I mean, if we could create something so perfect like Beethoven Fifth, well, I'm so proud actually that this music is there somewhere. And of course, no one can answer. And I'm not sure if anyone would ever be able to answer if there is any other life forms apart from those who are existing on Earth or not. It's probable. You never know. Of course, it's a different discussion. So,
sure.
So
at the same time, I'm never going to be able to listen to Beethoven's Fifth in the same way after the way you just described it. I mean, I think that's very exciting. I think that the audiences in approaching Beethoven's Fifth from that perspective of, you know, thinking, you know, why was this included in Voyager and how does this tie into these other pieces that Urbanski has chosen for this Out of This World Cosmos Festival. I think it's just going to be terrific.
Well, yeah, and it's important, actually. You know, of course, well, we can talk philosophically about the meaning of art and the meaning of music, but I think this connection with this Voyager and everything I just said, I think I found it very exciting. And, you know, when I was thinking myself on why did they select those pieces or whatever else they would select? I mean, there are many, so many more pieces. You know, if they would ask me for advice, I could I could give them so many other pieces that I consider perfect that show us as humans in the best light, in the best perspective.
Okay, so, then I'll ask you, what would be one piece you would select?
Well, to be completely honest with you, I would include Beethoven's Third Symphony, not the Fifth. The Fifth is, well, mostly popular, and everyone recalls it because it's such a popular piece. But I think if we are talking about a form of a symphony, like not only one movement, because they included only the first movement of the Beethoven Fifth Symphony, but symphony, like most of the symphonies are four movement pieces of art. So if you think about entire cycle, in my opinion, Eroica, Beethoven Third Symphony, is the greatest symphony ever written. And this is my personal perspective. I just like it more than Fifth. Maybe the first movement of Fifth, of course. It's perfect itself. But if you talk about all four movements, well, you don't have so much dramaturgy and direction in the meaning that you have in his Third Symphony. So, well, I might do slight alteration. I was never asked. Actually, I was not born yet when the capsule was sent in the universe. So my personal opinion does not count. But still, what is on this record? This is Beethoven Fifth. For instance, imagine. Okay, so being an alien, listening to this. Okay, after listening Bach, because there are some pieces of Bach, which we're also going to present. There is Second Brandenburg Concerto.
One of my
favorites. They would understand how logical it is. Okay, so these humans, as they call themselves, they created a language out of abstract waves, you know, and they could understand it after listening to Bach. Okay, with Beethoven, they would probably understand that they use it as the way of expressing themselves, okay, because there is just so much more tension and so much more emotion. But imagine also included on the record is the sacrificial dance from Rite of Spring, which is, well, vulgar, and it's impossible to understand. Even actually for people who are trained in music, they consider it a noise. Because it really sounds like a noise. It's just the rhythm. It's no melody, and it's aggressive. It's different.
Yeah.
So then, well, I'm not sure. I mean, so it makes it even more confusing. So what is the purpose of music? Like, okay, so it was a language in Bach's situation, very clear, mathematical. Then there was some more expression. But then, what did Stravinsky do with it? So you can actually really look on classical music or art as on entire universe.
Let me ask you this. Obviously, your interests go in many, many different places. And as you said, you had a great passion for science and still do. What did make you choose to pursue a career in music and not science? And also, why did you choose to pursue a musical career as a conductor as opposed to a performer?
Well, I was always dreaming to be a scientist because I used to think that I have to do something good for the world. And it was my personal goal. Like, I admire scientists who discover something. Like, for instance, there's so many scientists who discovered something. Or I especially admire scientists who can predict the future. Like, for instance, Stephen Hawking, it's just a simple example. Who predict that the black holes could evaporate, for instance. It's so new, and imagine those minds, those amazing minds, discussing things that nowhere even yet prove that they actually exist. Because many people would say, okay, why am I saying that black holes are not proof? We have so many proofs. No one have ever seen it. And we can calculate and we can estimate that, okay, there is a very great probability that we have black hole in the middle of this galaxy because of this or that, and etc. But, there are brains who are talking about the nature of it. And how smart you have to be to think about the nature of something you don't even know that it existed. Like, for instance, what Einstein did to our perception of the world. Well, what did Copernicus did for our perception of world, creating the idea of solar system with sun in the center. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not that previously people did not believe that Earth is, it was forbidden. This way of thinking was forbidden by, but we obviously know what the story is. So what is the universe and how we see it? That's the question, actually, because, what we think now, in 100 years, might be so much not up to date. Well, and they might actually, I'm trying to think about, this is how we see the past. Well, so altogether, I'm consider myself the happiest man in the world because of many things, but some of this is because I live in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because I know so much more than so many wise people living in 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so much more. And I would love to sit down with Isaac Newton and talk to him. Of course, I'm nothing comparing to this great, great mind. But I think he might be interested in some of the things I already know. He never had an idea about.
Sure.
And this is just simply because I live in this time. And I couldn't be happier. Because, I'm just proud that I know so much about the universe,
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud of humans, actually, that we all know so much about it. And that makes me, as I said, the happiest man in the world.
You have a very scientific mind. So I'm still curious, though, why did you choose then a musical career as opposed to a science career?
Oh, right. Sorry for not answering your questions.
No, not at all. It's fascinating philosophical. You talk about your concepts on this. And actually, I can see how a lot of your thoughts about science and philosophy apply to this. But, yeah.
Right. So I started with doing something important. Mm-hmm. And I consider scientists as people who are doing the most important things. Because I cannot see anything more important than finding an answer to a question, why? For what purpose?
Mm-hmm.
And how does the universe look? When did it start it? For what purpose? Who did create it? These are unanswered questions. So I thought that those who are making little steps in this direction to finding us an answer are those who mattered the most for myself. I think they're really making sense of our existence. But I just said some philosophical things about music, and these are things I actually discovered, maybe a few years ago. So I think actually that art, thinking of this Voyager thing, that art, for instance, music, is so important and gives us as a human, puts us in different perspective. Without art or without this Beethoven Fifth Symphony, we would not be as rich as we are. Would not be so proud as being human as I am right now. So I think in that perspective, I think that what I'm doing is still very important. And although I'm not a composer, I'm not creating this music, but without performance, those who sit on stage and passing it, composers would not write. They have to write for someone. So I consider myself as one little piece of the mechanism which really in total makes sense. So I think the art, I had a few thoughts about it, and after really thinking about it, I came to a conclusion that art really matters. And I think what all the artists are doing is, probably equally important to what our scientists are doing.
Do you remember what the first piece was that you conducted?
Well, it was my own piece.
Yeah?
Yes. I was trying to be a composer at that time.
Mm-hmm. How was that, conducting your own piece?
Well, terrible.
And so at that point, did you decide that you enjoyed the conducting, but maybe the composing wasn't the best way to go?
Yes, that's true. So the piece I wrote, simply I have no talent to become a composer. And that's how I become a conductor. So because it's not as creative as being a composer, because then you can do whatever you have in your mind. Being a conductor, you can only shape something that existed in the mind of the composer. But, since I have so much respect and since I admire those great pieces of music or great pieces of art so much, my task is to get into this universe, to get into the head of the composer and present this universe the best way I can.
Maestro Krzysztof Urbanski, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
The pleasure is entirely mine. Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Maestro Krzysztof Urbanski of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. From January 22nd through February 5th, the ISO will present Out of This World Cosmos Music Festival with Holst's The Planets, classical works from the film 2001 A Space Odyssey, and masterpieces by Mozart, Beethoven, and Stravinsky that were included in a time capsule on the spacecraft Voyager in 1977. To get more information about the ISO, visit IndianapolisSymphony.org, IndianapolisSymphony.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
We're all a week into our New Year's resolutions now.
Oh, goodness. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And if one of your resolutions was to see more arts events this year, we have some news for you on our calendar. We call
What Do We Do?
What do you have?
Well, you know what? I am excited about this concert going on this weekend up at the Palladium. Ramsey Lewis and his quartet.
Ooh, nice.
The In Crowd and 50th Anniversary Concert. And that is Saturday at 8 o'clock. Ramsey Lewis is amazing on the piano. I've had a chance to see him before. And if you want to hear some great jazz, check out this concert.
Fantastic. If you like Celtic music, listen up on Saturday, January 16th. Irish Arts Indie, as part of Indie Folk Series, is presenting a whole evening of traditional Irish music, language, stories, and song. I am 100% certain there will be sing-alongs involved. Find out more at indiefolkseries.org.
Very good. And this weekend, the classic Greats, A Perfect Meal of Dance with Dance Kaleidoscope from the 7th through the 10th at the One America stage at IRT. It's an appetizer, an entree, and a dessert of great classics from DK's repertoire that will be a lot of fun to see, including Romeo and Juliet and Frank's Way.
Whoa, wonderful. My last item for today is a guitar concert coming up on Thursday the 26th. Daniel Quinn, who is strongly influenced by guitar music from Japan. He is doing a concert as part of the Indianapolis Society of Classical Guitar Series. You can find out more at indianaguitar.org about that.
Nice. That sounds great. And hey, if you want to find out what else is going on, you can always check out the Arts Council of Indianapolis's website, indiearts.org/guide, or listen to us next week on that calendar we call.
What do we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
One of actor Bill Simmons' first gigs when he moved to Indianapolis was at Theater on the Square, a venue where he will soon be seen in David Hare's relationship comedy drama Skylight. Sharon Gamble invited Bill to talk about his role and the creative process.
Bill Simmons and Theater on the Square, it's been a little while?
It has been 20 years.
Whoa.
Yeah, the last show I did there was 1996. A guy named Steve Trainor directed it. It had Adam Crowe in the cast.
Yeah.
It was Neil Simon's Laughter in the 23rd Floor.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while.
It's been a long time, yes, yes.
And a very different play from this one.
Yeah, very different. This is David Hare's Skylight that was just revived on Broadway with Bill Nighy and Carey Mulligan. And it's a wonderful, it's three actors, but really all the scenes are just two characters.
Primarily the two.
Yeah. And very different. It's about a relationship that went badly. There was an extramarital affair for the man and a very young woman involved. And now they haven't seen each other in 3 years, and she's 30 and he's pushing 50, and his wife has passed away. And, you know, you're never quite sure. I don't think the audience is exactly sure why he's come back. I mean, he's obviously come back to try and find if there's anything there. But you're not quite sure if he's lonely, if he's, you know, if she was the love of his life. That part's a little, David Hare doesn't make that very explicit. So it's a really, and she's, it's a very interesting play about two really strong-willed people who clearly loved each other very much, yet even now when they're free to be together, you realize their history is weighing them down quite a bit, and their history with each other is weighing them down quite a bit.
His son, your character's son, shows up at your character's former mistress's apartment,
right,
and is kind of nudging. He kind of wants the former mistress to get together with you.
Yeah, I think so. His mother has died a year earlier when the play begins. And
there's no way he could be.
No, huh?
Yeah,
no.
Okay.
When the ingenue came into our lives, she was 18, and two children had already been born.
Yeah, okay.
So in a way, the character of Kira has been sort of a surrogate mother. Even when my wife was alive, she was sort of a surrogate mother to my two children, because my wife and I were restaurateurs and opening hotels and obviously gone quite a bit. And I think that the character of Kira really served as a surrogate mother to Edward, and the daughter's name is Hillary, and she's not a character in the play and is hardly ever discussed. And he comes back, I think, really with that intention of trying to get Kira to see Tom, that's my character, to get Kira to see Tom again. And by happenstance, Tom actually shows up later that same evening at the apartment.
Great mind, same wavelength.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a boy. Edward is 18, and, you know, he's a boy who's now left alone with his father, who is distant and, you know, still completely driven by opening more restaurants and hotels. And, you know, he's very passionate about business. And so you get a sense the boy is lonely. And he's, you know, Kira was the, I think, was the adult figure in his life that gave him some grounding. And
right,
so,
and was kind to him.
Very much so.
Kira worked in the hotel and restaurant business,
right,
or more, okay.
Yeah, she shows up. It's in the play where their backstory is explained a little bit. She shows up one night looking for a job, and my daughter has been hit by a car. And so I'm off in a meeting. My wife, the character of Alice, well, she's not a character in the play, but Alice says, "I'm leaving you in charge." And Kara's like, "I just started." And she's like, "Oh, you're fine. I can already tell you're going to be great in this job." And they go off and don't come back till 4 a.m. And Kira's essentially managed this restaurant, with the help, of course, the staff.
Trial by fire, though.
Exactly.
Whoa.
And they get back from the hospital, and she's still waiting for them at the restaurant. It's 4 a.m. He talks about, you know, "I remember you bringing us brandy and coffee in our own restaurant, and I had never seen you before in my life, and it all seemed completely natural." And Kira spends 6 years with the family, and they start, Tom and Kira start an affair very shortly thereafter. All the while that Kira's living in the house with Tom and Alice and the two children.
And Alice never knows, we think.
She never knows. I think she gets wise to it. And then there's a plot point. I won't spoil it for you.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
But there's a plot development where you realize that there are some incriminating love letters that Tom may or may not have left out on purpose. And it's very David Hare.
Yeah.
If you know Plenty, The Vertical Hour, you know, he really likes very complex, smart people, but very complex and don't always act in their own best interests.
Oh, you mean like real life?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, for people who are like, wait, love letters, not emails. This play dates to the mid-90s.
Yes.
And while that seems maybe a little recent, it's before most people had internet access. So hence no emails.
Yeah. And it's sort of interesting because the character as you're hearing their backstory, you find out that Kira's gone off on holiday and Tom begs her to write letters to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so she does. And she says, "I'm not, you know, I was never a natural letter writer, but you asked me for those letters." And you know, even for this audiences today who aren't used to, you know, receiving handwritten letters in the mail, you understand that, oh, he purposefully asked for something in her handwriting to come through the old snail mail that he could open and touch. And
this is a British playwright. Are you doing British accents? Or?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. I've been working like a dog in mine.
And Tom comes from kind of a hard scrabble background and has pulled himself up.
Yes, he has. He's loosely modeled on a few people. When you sort of start doing the research, he's probably most closely patterned on a man named Terence Conrad. And if you've ever heard of the Conrad Shops, that's his.
A big style maker.
Very big style maker. And it's even to this day. I mean, Terence Conrad is still with us in his 80s and is still kind of the style guru in England for classical contemporary, I guess is what I would call his style, his aesthetic. And there could be a couple of other people he's based on as well. Mm-hmm. But when you listen to Terence Conrad, any trace of his childhood is so pressed down by the persona he's created for himself. He's got a very posh accent. Now, mine will be sort of kind of Michael Gambon, if you remember the actor who played Dumbledore at the end of the Harry Potter series, and a bunch of other things. Michael Gambon was actually the first Tom when Skylight first premiered.
Okay.
And in fact, when David Hare was approached about reviving Skylight, he went to Michael Gambon first, and Michael Gambon said, you know,
I'm too old now.
Well, he didn't say he was too old. He said, you should get that other guy you like so much, which is Bill Nighy. Because Bill Nighy did The Vertical Hour on Broadway with Julianne Moore a few years back.
And what a versatile actor he
totally
is.
Totally, man.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, there's a – if you and I think I actually saw it in WFYI. There was a – David Hare wrote a script for television called Page 8.
Yes, I watched that recently.
I just rewatched it again to watch Bill Nighy. It's wonderful. And it's got Judy Davis in it, who I think is extraordinary. They have a wonderful scene together in this restaurant. But it's total David Hare, very
espionage
smart.
And,
exactly. Yeah. Michael Gambon is in that as well. Rachel Weisz. It's just a wonderful cast. I think Ben Whishaw's in it as well. So.
The Indianapolis Library System has it on DVD if you're so inclined and have a little time here in the winter to watch. So so Tom is a self-made man. Kira comes from a little bit more well-to-do family and has kind of chosen, not that she's trying not to be well-to-do, but she's chosen to teach underprivileged children, right?
Right. Tom even mocks her at one point and says, you know, growing up next to stormy English seas with a governess and a seaside solicitor's daughter, and because now she's living in one tough end of London, and she actually has a commute to the other side of London to another tough place where she's teaching. And so she's actually been the one who had the upbringing early on where she had some degree of affluence. And now she's living in a terrible apartment. And in fact, Tom frequently draws it to her attention that she's living in this godforsaken place and has to travel all the way across London and teach in another godforsaken part of town and then travel all the way back. And it's sort of a point of contention because he's obviously quite proud of what he's accomplished in his life. And while Kira was living with Tom and Alice, she enjoyed all that privilege as well. You know, they obviously ate well because they were restaurateurs.
Sure.
And lived in a very posh part of London.
He must be mystified by why she would choose this life.
There are frequent outbursts of Tom. It's like, Kira, I don't understand why you're living like this. You know, not only did you come from better, but while you lived with us, you lived much better. And now she doesn't even have heating in her apartment. She's got a little tiny space heater.
Was she his protege? In her eyes and in his eyes, or in his eyes.
I think so. There's a lot of interesting, obviously, it's David Hare. There are a lot of interesting exchanges. But he has this one exchange with her about how, Kira, you know, you lived with us for 3 weeks and then you told me that you were going off to university and how you weren't going to spend your life in the catering trade. And she says, I never use the word catering trade in my life. And, you make me sound so, I forget what the word she uses. And then that's when I say to her, oh, impossible, a seaside solicitor's daughter? Are you saying some of that hasn't rubbed off? And so I think in some ways they were good for each other because they poked at those places where most of us don't like to be poked about, you know, things that we're like, we know they're true about ourselves. Mm-hmm. It's when other people see those facts and also want to bring them to our attention. Mm-hmm. And I think Tom and Kira's relationship obviously – I mean, in the night the audience gets to watch them together, you realize not only do you get a lot of backstory, but you get a lot of why they were probably really good for each other and why their affair worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's nice about this play is, like, you sort of are rooting for them. It's like, well, Tom is free. You know, his wife is dead. The boy clearly wants Kira back in his life.
And Kira's a grown-up, old enough to make a decision like this now.
She's 30. She's working with underprivileged kids. She's got her head clearly screwed on straight, probably straighter than Tom's. And so at the end, I think the audience is like, okay, is this going to happen? Is this going to happen?
We're not going to tell you in this interview.
No, I'd hate to do that.
And I want to say there's some humor as well.
Oh, it's very funny. It's very... It's a lot of it is very character driven. I mean, Tom is such a, you know, she talks about his energy and he's a whirlwind and, you know, he's always moving around her apartment, picking up things and using them to tell stories. And all the while she's actually cooking a meal. She's actually making.
She's making pasta?
Pasta with sauce from scratch.
And he does not entirely approve of how she's
no
cooking.
Well, being a restaurateur, he has very very distinct ideas about how you should be cooking pasta and sauce from scratch. Not the pasta she cooks from scratch, but certainly the sauce. And so he starts pestering her about, well, you're going to put the chilies in first, right? The chilies infuse the oil. And she says, well, I'm going to do it my way. And she's like, well, of course you are, because that's how you always were doing things your way.
I understand she gets to throw some cutlery at you.
Oh, yeah.
Have you done that much in rehearsal yet?
Gary Williams, our director, she's fantastic. And we actually started working on the play back in November. She had some early read-throughs, gave us some assignments, which is, as a director, I like to work that way.
What kind of assignments?
Being able to answer questions about, you know, what you want from what you want in a scene. Mm. And having been a former journalist, I equate it to who, what, when, where, why, mm-hmm. how. It's like writing a news story. So when I approach a scene, I always like, okay, who am I talking to? What is it I want from them? How will I know I get it? So if I want an apology or I want Kira to say, yes, Tom, you are always you're the love of my life, and how will I know I've got what I want? She's gonna raise her hand and say, I promise you, I'm running off to your house in the West Indies with you. So if that's what I'm going for as an actor, it makes it. I have an objective, and so everything, the whole scene is about trying to elicit that response from her, my point of view about Kira changes. Sometimes she's the stubborn mule. Sometimes she's the beautiful treasure. Sometimes she's the wicked adversary. And so that's what Gary gave us that assignment to do back in early November, which was, you know, start really like look, not just memorize lines, but what does Kira's name mean to you when you say it at that particular moment in the play? Mm-hmm. What is your action on trying to get her to admit that she ran off and left you with two kids and, you know, an angry wife and whatever. It's just, and as a director, I like to do the same thing. I'll bring a cast together a little early in the process, about 6 or 8 weeks before we start the official rehearsal period. Give them assignments, particularly if there's character work. When I directed Typhoid Mary at the Phoenix Theater last spring, I had three actors, two of whom had to play 5 or 6 different characters.
Right.
For me, it's all about character work. If I can get really meaty character work out of actors, you'd be surprised how a story will open up. And so that's one of the things I gave Ben Asakwe and Jolene Moffat. I'm like, really, start finding these characters now. We'll find them in rehearsals too. But if something lands on you, let that character breathe in your daily life. You know, wash dishes as Typhoid Mary. You know, vacuum as Typhoid Mary. Walk the dog as Typhoid Mary. And so that's what Gary did with us, was got us started on dialect, character work, and really starting to analyze scenes. What is it we want, and how we know we're going to get it.
Sharon Gamble with Bill Simmons. You can see Bill, Sarah McGee, and Tyler Ostrander, directed by Gary Williams, in David Hare's Skylight at the Theater on the Square from January 22nd through February 13th. You can get tickets and more information at TOTS, that's TOTS.org, TOTS.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I'll find out what surprises the Winter Magic Fest has for us.
Uh-oh, I hope they don't steal your voice. I'll get a preview of the Phoenix Theater's late winter and spring season.
And I'll chat with Richard McCoy about the art scene in Columbus, Indiana. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? That and more next weekend on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.